As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see. Today's show is sponsored in part by ManageEngine and their OpManager network management software. OpManager integrates NetFlow monitoring, configuration management, firewall log management, IP address management, and more, all in a single product. Go to opmanager.com/packetpushers to get a free 30-day trial.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on data networking. Today, we're looking closely at OpenStack networking by talking with people who are on the ground making this work for one of the biggest and most successful gaming companies are in the world today. Now, OpenStack, as most of you know, is a cloud orchestration system. It's actually more of an operating system for cloud platforms, for private clouds, and I've been fairly bullish on the whole OpenStack thing, but I also have been saying that it's not ready for the prime time. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't using it. It just means that if you've not got a grown up and mature set of managers, you're probably not going to be able to make them think in the right way or change the way they see the world. And so OpenStack isn't going to work for you. So just to talk around those sorts of topics, I'm going to introduce Steve Armstrong from Paddy Power Betfair. Steve, please tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name's Stephen Armstrong. I work for Paddy Power Betfair as the principal automation engineer. So I look after the continuous delivery pipelines at Paddy Power Betfair. So that involves treating infrastructure as code, networking as code, basically everything that you can think of as code.
Ah, sure. And also with us is Mark Pryor. Hey, Mark, introduce yourself.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mark Pryor. I am an infrastructure architect working in the consultancy practice at Computer Center. I've been in the networking industry now for over 20 years. And I joined the IT Working Group, which is the project name for the Infrastructure as a Service project at Paddy Power Betfair. I'm guessing it's almost 2 years ago now. So I joined to help them with the physical network and also some of the SDN selection stuff, really, as part of the original RFP.
Right. So, Steve, Paddy Power Betfair is a gaming website. And what you do is basically people get to some people call it gaming, some people would call it gambling, some people would call it betting. Is that a fair summary of what Paddy Power Betfair does?
It's probably a little bit more than that. We're basically run an exchange where gamblers will essentially lay bets against each other, and then we take a commission off of it. So we're more probably aligned in terms of technology as an exchange, and that's how we kind of describe ourselves.
When you say exchange, you're not talking mail exchange, you're talking trading exchange, where for every sell there's a buy order and you're in the middle of that transaction.
Yeah, so we just take a commission for people using our product, essentially. Yeah, so that's really at the heart of what we do. So we also have a sports book as well, so that's more the traditional gaming application.
I think my favourite sports thing is the virtual greyhounds that you've got. That's, you know, when I learned about virtual greyhounds, I think that was the day I thought that gaming might have gone too far. But then we saw Pokemon Go this week, and then I thought, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
Nintendo finally taking it to the masses, right?
That's right. Yeah. So talk a little bit about the pathway that led Betfair to adopting OpenStack, because obviously Betfair's got a big web-based infrastructure. You're presenting a massive app. You're delivering thousands of trading transactions. You're settling transactions at a rate of thousands or hundreds of thousands per second, I imagine. How did you get to OpenStack from where you were before, which was bare metal, just very quickly?
So one of the real reasons that we wanted to implement it was really to programmatically control the infrastructure. So we had a series of long-lived servers that we would just cater for over time. So we would do in-place patching and basically just have to look after them. So that made the maintenance quite difficult. Although it was robust and has served us well, we really wanted to take it to the next level and kind of give our development teams that AWS-like ability and the private cloud. So we basically went to market again a couple of years ago to look at the current solutions that were available, and that really led us to OpenStack. because it allows you to control compute, storage, and networking from a common set of APIs that we can program against. So that was really one of the biggest drivers. And it was also kind of acting like our infrastructure middleware. So essentially that sits in the middle. We talk to that rather than going to third-party vendor APIs. We just didn't really want to tie the automation that we built into something that would potentially go out of date. So using open source software was really...
So what you're saying is that operating closed source operating systems, you saw them as being obsolete quicker or just not flexible or just some combination thereof?
So it was a five-year project. So really we wanted to tie into something that was going to allow us... Because some vendors couldn't guarantee that they wouldn't change their product. So the open source OpenStack project meant that you have backward compatibility on APIs, so they're not going to just switch that out. One of the main things around that was we were looking at configuration management tools to orchestrate it as well. So with Ansible, they basically use the OpenStack Shade library, which is maintained by the OpenStack Foundation. So basically... all the upgrades that they do to the OpenStack software means that essentially that library is maintained and it maintains backward compatibility. So the Ansible modules for OpenStack are basically written against that shade library. So you know if you use the shade library that it will interact with any OpenStack cloud and not break. So if we ever needed to move across to another OpenStack vendor, it would be fine and we could still use the same orchestration.
Because you're spending more time, and I think as we get through the show, I think we'll come clearer, but what you're effectively saying is that you think you're spending much more money and resources in the automation pipeline than you are in getting the OpenStack to work. It's more important that your automation system works than the actual OpenStack underneath that matters.
Sure. So basically the automation pipelines that we use could easily be as applicable to AWS, and we can also use it against Livevert or Overt. We're kind of proved that out, so it's like an agnostic framework that we've written at Paddy Power Betfair. So, but OpenStack's really at the heart of it because it gives us the ability to kind of provision servers on demand. The thing that it actually gave us is we need to be able to provision bare metal servers as well as virtual machines.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives us that capability that AWS doesn't really.
Oh, that's because of the, is it Rocket, the bare metal project? I'm trying to think of what it's called.
No, it's Ironic.
Ironic, that's it. I knew it was associated with iron somehow. I couldn't quite remember. I'm not sure I got Rocket from, probably Container Lands. So the OpenStack gives you, so effectively from your point of view, if I hear you right, is that OpenStack is a set of APIs that you call. That's really all it is. Is if you say, I want a server, you send an API, a server is created when you want to provision a bare metal server, and that's what it does for you?
Yeah, so it has a subset of drivers, so you can plug in anything that you want. So if you're using HP or Dell, you can plug them both in at the compute layer. If you've got an SDN controller, that can plug into Neutron. Mm. So it's very flexible.
So that's really a different way of looking at your infrastructure. That's what you're saying, is that you were looking at infrastructure as code, and OpenStack is a key part of that code that you need?
Yes. So essentially, one of the things as well when you're road mapping a project, you have to kind of depend on the vendor's roadmap. One of the things that we can do in the future now is if OpenStack lacks a particular feature that we may need, we could use our test lab to submit a pull request back to the open source community and try and get it through into the upstream project. So we would be building and contributing as well. And that works very well with what we want to do.
Is that more successful than doing it with a commercial vendor? Do you feel that, like, you could always ask a vendor to add a feature to a product?
Doesn't always get added though, right?
No, so I'm asking a leading question, right? I know the answer, but I'm not supposed to, you know.
Yeah, so I think that's the way the industry is really going. It's more open sourcing everything so people can see what the code actually looks like, look at it, see if they want to use it and contribute back.
I just want to understand here, I was going to talk about the continuous integration, continuous delivery, but I think this is the right point to talk about it. You actually have a full automation and deployment pipeline. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we use, for our networking component, we use the Nuage SDN. Mm-hmm. So what that really does is it builds out a full object model. So you've got your organization, your layer three domains. Underneath that, we have our subnets. So we essentially use AB subnets. So we deploy release A into subnet A, spin up the application, basically roll it onto a load balancer. And then when the next release comes in, we'll bring up subnet B. So your ACL rules might have actually changed. You don't want to interrupt the running production application in the original subnet. So you apply a new subnet. You then basically put the application on there, roll it over the load balancer, doing a zero downtime deployment, and then essentially you blow away the previous set of VMs and subnet and ACL rules. So that does automatic cleanup. So that's kind of the way our deployment pipelines work. So with our CI process, each of those components that make up the pipeline are very modular. So we basically tag everything in GitLab. So essentially when we've got config for our SDN config or load balancer config, that's all just tagged at specific versions and then pulled down to, and it's executed using Ansible as well. So that's just a bar file structure.
So you're literally saying you build a config, but it's all the actual process of deploying so the way gaming sites work is that you have a bunch of VMs, some of them are web servers, some of them middleware, and there's a database somewhere at the back end. And when you want to upgrade the application software that runs on the web servers and the middleware, instead of doing it the old way, which is to turn the site off and then upgrade all the code on the operating systems and then cross your fingers when it comes back, you've actually got a whole bunch of VMs over here automatically deployed using orchestration and automation, and then you just go to the load balancers and say, switch from the old site to the new site. Boom, done.
Yeah. So it's a completely immutable infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So we basically only keep boxes for 30 days on the infrastructure, and then they're refreshed. So all patching, for instance, that used to be done in place is now done at the start of the cycle. So we'll put out a new image, which will essentially be patched at the start, and then the teams will just consume that new image. So we produce CentOS 6 and 7 images using Packer to do that.
And that's automated again as well?
Yeah, it's all automated. So basically we do image packaging each week. So that runs, it will take all the new RHEL EPO repo patches down, install all the necessary RPMs so that it's all patched up to the latest version.
And then once a month you flip. And that's a bit like the old mainframe days, right? Where we used to IPL the mainframe.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
It sounds very similar. Because in the mainframe, memory leaks were always a worry. So most companies used to IPL the mainframe once a month, and there'd be like two halves to the mainframe, the A and the B. And at the end of every month after the accounting run was done, they'd IPL it to the other side.
I guess with our manifest file, because all of those components make up a manifest file, they're just versioning those Git repositories. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you want to do a rollback, you just roll back to the previous known version of the manifest file that's been tested all the way through to production.
Now, the testing's automated as well. So your app is actually, you build this image, and then you actually run tests against the built image with the applications on it before it goes live.
Yeah, so we have different test environments in OpenStack. So we use availability zones to basically do that. Mm. So essentially we've got a quality assurance availability zone, which maps to the Nuage layer 3 domain quality assurance zone. And then essentially we've got an integration one, we've got a performance, and then a production one. So each release will propagate through all those different availability zones in OpenStack and through the layer three domain. So we test precisely the same way in QA, NXT, perf, and prod. Mm-hmm. So the teams will actually know that their application will function properly when it gets to prod, and it passes all the the test gates.
Okay, so let's start talking more about the networking side. So you said earlier that you're running NewArch Networks as a SDN platform. How did you get to the process of deciding to buy NewArch Networks or to move ahead with NewArch Networks? Like, there are dozens of others. There's Open Daylight, there's, you know, NSX, there's ACI, there's many, many different SDN platforms you could have chosen through. How did you come down to choosing NewArch?
Basically, we selected Red Hat to be our partner for OpenStack. Mm-hmm. And what we really wanted to do was get, because we were interested in the SDN. Mm-hmm. So we weren't actually sure as a business what SDN vendor to pick. So it was Red Hat that actually partnered with NewArch, as part of the RFP process and introduced us to NewArch, which is probably one of the best kept secrets because we weren't aware of NewArch at the time.
Yes.
But we basically in the RFP laid out everything that we wanted to try and achieve with the software-defined networking. So they ticked all of the boxes. But as you said, there's multiple SDN vendors, but we've been really happy with NewArch.
So you've got no reason to leave them, is what you're saying?
No. I think NewArch has been fantastic. So NewArch and Arista that we've used, and Mark can tell you more about Arista, but essentially we've been very happy with both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think NewArch as a kind of almost like an OpenStack partner have been brilliant because their kind of engineering focus on OpenStack has been really, really helpful in this project. I think if we'd gone in another direction, we possibly wouldn't have had that. Mm. So that's been really key.
So you actually think, so the fact is that NewArch doesn't work on VMwares.
Oh, it does.
Well, it does, but it's got to do some nasty hacks. It doesn't have the level of control over the vSwitch. Is that right?
I wouldn't like to comment too much on that, but it's not as integrated as NSX would be with VMware. That's right, for sure.
But that's a feature in this case because it's NewArch is focused much more on making OpenStack.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. And then they've done some really cool things for us along the way that I don't think we necessarily would have got from any other SDN vendor.
I think it's more from that perspective. It's more NewArch will plug into anyone that runs Open vSwitch. So essentially, because there's not an Open vSwitch integration with ESXi, mm-hmm. you have to kind of spoof that and simulate it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if the hypervisor was a bit more open.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not a criticism of anybody, but, you know, VMware owns its platform and, you know, they choose not to open it up too much to other people. Which is fine, you know, that's their choice, and that's a perfectly fine business model. But equally, that also means that for NewArch, they're much more focused on OpenStack because they can do more there, and that, in your situation, is specifically a feature, right?
Yeah, they also have integrate with CloudStack as well. I think some of their biggest customers are actually CloudStack as well. So, it's quite an open platform. So we're looking at vendors that could agnostically plug in.
So, and NewArch Network, so most people when they get OpenStack play around with the ML2 or go with the Open Daylight. You think NewArch Networks is superior in lots of ways? What sort of ways? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, so I think one of the features that we're looking to integrate soon, and we've just discussed today actually, is their Ironic integration, which allows them to manage bare metal policy the same way as virtualization. So essentially you can apply the same ACL rules to your bare metal machines and manage it in the same way. So that was a big plus for us. One of the things that I've been really impressed with is they have network macros. So a network macro sounds like it's a programmatic thing, but it's probably just a bit badly named. Essentially what it does.
Firewall external.
It bridges into your native network. So this has allowed us to actually, instead of doing a big bang approach where we basically switch all of Paddy Power Betfair onto the new OpenStack estate, we essentially bridge back to native. So we have machines and applications sitting on our Citrix Xen environment, and then we basically bridge back to them using NewArch, and it allows you to do that through their GRT hub domain. which I'm sure Mark could go into much more detail on than me.
All right, Mark, here's your chance. Tell us.
I was just going to say, for those who aren't familiar with Paddy Power Betfair, native is what we call our kind of legacy estate, if you like.
All right.
So this is the old environment, and while we're in flux with the migration of applications, obviously there's a lot of dependencies between the two.
Right. So and what's GRT?
GRT Hub is, so the nice thing about NewArch is it uses a lot of very classic networking constructs, mm-hmm. VRFs being one of them, and VRF is like your central VRF, like your where you leak all of the VRF domains into it. It's like your, I've forgotten the term, but your default VRF, if you like.
Yeah, the global VRF.
NewArch. And it's where you actually exit and enter the VXLAN fabric.
Right, okay.
In NewArch. So we have hardware devices, the VSG, which provide that gateway function between the VXLAN fabric and the outside world. Essentially, they attach to the GRT hub domain.
So the VSG is a NewArch Networks switch, which runs their operating system and has the capability to do VXLAN termination in hardware for high-speed connectivity. So when you come in from the overlay network in the NewArch, you know, everything's via. Now all of a sudden you've got to strip the VXLAN tag to bring it into native VLANs, or this switch has the specific silicon capability in the software to do that.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, exactly right.
Were you able to get that redundant? Like, when I've looked at other people's VXLAN terminations, it's been very difficult to get a switch that allows you to do layer 2 and layer 3 in the VXLAN edge point. So that is not only bridge the layer 2 out of a VX, so L2 in the VXLAN header, and you can map it into a VLAN, but you also want to be able to route it on there. Can it do that in the VSG?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've in each data center, we've got two pairs of VSGs. Mm-hmm. Each pair is currently clustered, and we do ECMP between those pairs of VSGs. So we've got rack resilience because we have a pair of VSGs in one rack and a pair of VSGs in the other, and we can either do ECMP or we can control load through them.
Right. Those gateways go down, then the VXLAN termination points fail over to the alternate switch, and transparently you don't see that.
Exactly, yeah. It's very quick. Mm-hmm. We'll be breaking them out from those virtual chassis on the next version release and having them as just four independent gateways and just use ECMP entirely across all four. And then that'll allow us to do some better failover stuff with BGP, which is how
all
we
right,
peer
so what peer you're saying right now network. Is it's like an MLAG solution? It's like a...
It's like a virtual chassis, like a Cisco VSS or a 3750 stack or whatever. That's how they operate today. But we're going to break them out so they fail over a bit quicker. We built the underlay network using Arista, as Steve's already touched upon, and we've used BGP as our layer 3 routing protocol. So the VSGs actually peer to the Aristas using BGP.
Right. And that's how the fundamentally the under network or the underlay is put together, is with the Aristas providing the fundamental Ethernet connectivity and then the VSGs doing the VXLAN terminations.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we use VXLAN on the Arista side as well, because of some of the requirements from OpenStack to extend layer 2 networking. Mm. We've built a CLOS architecture, a spine leaf network, using eBGP between pairs of leaf switches in the spine. Mm-hmm. Works very, very well. It's extremely fast failover. It's worked really well for us. But because we've got that layer 3 separation down to rack, to constrain the broadcast domains as far as we can, there was always a thought in the back of our minds when we were going through the RFP that we would need some kind of layer 2 extension between racks. So using the Arista VXLAN with their CVX product as a kind of VXLAN controller, if you like, was in our back pocket should we ever need it. And because we need to extend the internal API from OpenStack across all racks, we've used it in a certain kind of corner cases, if you like, on the network.
So does that mean that you're then orchestrating the Arista switches through OpenStack as well?
No. If you deploy a SDN type overlay, and I'm sure you know this, Greg, you have a very limited subset of VLANs that you actually need to configure on the underlay network. You really need just to support the VXLAN as a transport. So you typically have a transport VLAN. You know, we've got a storage VLAN for iSCSI, and that internal API that I've mentioned. So our underlay is very, very simple and consistent in terms of how it's configured, which has allowed us to automate the delivery of it. But we do that through Arista's zero-touch provisioning server in combination with a bit of Python and a bit of Ansible and a custom plugin that we worked with Arista on developing.
Right.
So
you're using Ansible to provision the Arista gear where it needs to be provisioned?
Yeah, so, well, we used zero-touch provisioning server, which from Arista. It's a power-on provisioning server. If you're familiar with Cisco, I think they probably work in a similar way, but it's very open. It's very customizable, which has been a benefit. So
everybody's got one. It's not just an Arista thing. It's a
Everybody's got something of
that. Everybody's got a power on automatic provisioning type system. Yeah,
of something, some description.
Yeah.
So we used that for the initial deployment. Wrote a set of templates and a set of configs. Stuck them into zero touch provisioning. Worked out how we could deliver first the management network, because we've got a separate management network, outbound management network. And then once that management network's built, the main spine leaf network connects into the management network, and then that can be built all automatically using ZTPS. And then as we scale out the network, we bring in new racks, we'll use ZTPS again, pre-provisioned ahead of time to upgrade the image and download the configurations for the new racks. And we also built a custom plugin to configure the spine switches for BGP for that new rack as they come in. Yeah. So, you know, we don't need to automate necessarily the day-to-day task, because from a BAU perspective, it's not going to be touched that much. Mm-hmm. Although we can use Ansible to do that. We used Ansible for some of the testing. Mm. And so, you know, we use Ansible for repeatable changes where required, but there isn't quite the same need to do it
Because most of it's done in the OpenStack.
Yeah, most of it's done in NuArch.
Well, most of the change is happening in the OpenStack. The change isn't happening at the physical layer; it's happening in the software layers.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what this allows us to do as well, when we scale out new racks, we basically use OpenStack Director, which is the Triple O project. So essentially, that's the installer. So we just scale out our hypervisors horizontally as the racks come in. So we've basically done some customizations to the heat templates that build that out to incorporate the leaf spine topology into it. So we worked with Red Hat on that to carry that out. So we support leaf spine for everything. So that's also supported from the OpenStack side. So that was one of the key things that we needed to do when we adopted OpenStack, was make sure that OpenStack Director supported that.
Let's pause the show just for a minute to talk about our sponsor today, OpManager from ManageEngine. OpManager is a complete network management platform for network and server monitoring, bandwidth analysis, IP address and switch port management, configuration management, and more. And it is available as a single .exe file, not 15 different programs you have to download. Let's talk about a couple of OpManager features you might not have heard about before. And the first one is backing up all your device configurations into a central repository. When you've got them, now you can compare changes, restore previous configurations, and check those configurations for compliance with a standard. And then if a configuration is out of compliance, OpManager can bring the device configuration into compliance for you in a context and vendor-aware way. And another cool feature of OpManager is the ability to monitor Windows, VMware, and Xen servers, including processes and services. In other words, OpManager is not just a plain old network monitoring system for your routers and switches. It can also handle many of the servers in your data center using SNMP, WMI, vCenter, and more. This is a powerful tool here. OpManager can scale to 50,000 devices or 1 million interfaces and includes workflow automation for troubleshooting and remediation and colorized WAN links for easy performance alerting. You also get a customizable dashboard with multiple views for operators and managers, and all of these features, again, part of a single installation. That makes OpManager easy to install and evaluate. If you'd like to do that, go to opmanager.com/packetpushers and get a free 30-day trial. And thanks to ManageEngine for being a sponsor. And now back to the show.
Let's walk through the deployment cycle. So when you come to building VLANs in the overlay or in the NuArch networks, do you then script all of that using OpenStack APIs, or do you talk directly to the NuArch SDN controller? Or do you do both, I guess, is the third choice, I suppose.
So there's two ways that you can actually do it. You have NuArch managed subnets. when you implement new edge networks, or you can have OpenStack managed subnets. So obviously, if you use OpenStack managed subnets with new edge, basically you can only use the OpenStack functionality. So we use new edge managed subnets. So essentially, it's a one-to-one mapping between the subnet and OpenStack and new edge using that. So essentially, we don't use security groups on OpenStack. We use new edge ACL rules.
Right.
And that allows us to use the set up an ACL rule to a network macro for an external network, which is essentially our native network. So that gives us those features. So to orchestrate that, to answer your question, we've basically written some Ansible modules that have wrapped the new edge Python SDK. Which is just a series of REST calls. So we've basically got self-service workflows that the development teams use to create their Layer 3 subnets and ACL rules. So they'll just fill in some YAML config files to do that.
Right.
So that's how they interact with it. So we just created a set of workflow actions to create VMs, create Layer 3 subnets, create the ACL rules.
And then but you're not talking to the Neutron ML2 interface. You're not using OpenStack API.
With new edge on the controllers, we switch off the ML2 and Layer 3 agent and use the new edge plugin instead, which basically just talks REST API calls to the VSD, the new edge VSD.
Yeah, Virtual Services Director.
Yeah.
So there is two ways. There's two ways you can deploy NuAge. You can deploy it just with the ML2 plugin, and then you accept all the constraints of the ML2 plugin. Or you can take it on as we've done it, which I think they call advanced mode, which opens up all the features of NuAge to you. And when we create a subnet in NuAge, it gets kind of almost upstream to Neutron, and imported into Neutron. So it then appears in OpenStack for VMs to attach.
All right, the data from the NuAge VSD is still appearing in the OpenStack system, like it still shows up in the OpenStack interface because you're still exporting the data from VSD into OpenStack Director.
So Correct. It does that when you create a new vport against it, it intercepts that. So that's how the plugin works. So basically, when you provision on a OpenStack subnet, it'll basically pop up new vport, intercept that vport, and then it detects the VMs.
Right.
So basically, it uses something called a net partition to do that. So in the new edge object tree, you map your organization to your controllers, your OpenStack controllers. So essentially, it knows when you provision into that, using that particular organization UUID, that it will pick that up and basically create the vports and subnets and map them together. So it's a pretty slick integration.
Sounds like it. I just thought that was really, I think that's key, is to understand you're talking directly to the VSD or the NuAge controller instead of using OpenStack functionality. But you don't lose out on the feedback loop, which says this is how the network's configured. It's still there in OpenStack because it's still a link between the two.
Yeah, I mean, if you use it the other way around, you create security groups and then they show up in NuAge. So basically, they've got a two-way link. So it's a pretty great plugin.
Okay. So how do you test this stuff, right? You said before that you do testing and you're using infrastructure as code. And if you're going to do code, you've got to have tests because the code can go crazy and do bad things, right? So how do you test it? What do you do to test stuff? What insights have you got there?
So essentially, we use pre-production environments to do the testing. So we've got a test pipeline that we put everything through. What we're looking at doing at the moment is using Ansible Lint, and we also use Test Kitchen, which basically does infrastructure unit testing. So we're looking at actually spoofing out and writing some tests before we upstream our NuAge modules. So we're adding them as part of that using Lint, which is Python-based sets of unit tests.
We also trigger pen testing, right, Steve, with Qualys as part of this?
Yes.
Yeah.
So as part of it as well, we'll basically do a quality scan.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're doing quality assurance testing, we'll essentially spin up a quality scanner,
mm-hmm.
do a full scan of the network, do a full scan of the actual images as well, and see any vulnerabilities. If they break, we'll basically stop the pipeline, just like if a developer test phase will fail. Mm-hmm. And then that creates a continuous feedback loop. Thanks for that, Mark. I forgot about that.
Because that's pretty cool, right? Because most people run a pen tester once a quarter, maybe, if they're lucky, and then they ignore the results. But what you're actually saying is you build the app ready for deployment, and then you deploy it, and if it fails the security scan, then it actually stops deploying, like the deploy, it registers as a bug or a ticket, and then it has to be fixed.
Yeah, so what the teams actually do there is basically the output from the quality scan, if they've got a vulnerability over a Sev 3, I think it is, basically that will fail the pipeline. So what the team does is then they will go to ServiceNow and they'll put basically the Qualys IDs in.
Mm.
So they can be granted an exception, which the security team will review. So they get exception. No, they do.
Yeah, they'll review it and maybe they'll either pass it or they won't, you know, but yeah.
So it gets an automatic exception at that point.
Yeah.
And then basically that kicks off a security CI build.
Mm-hmm.
So then the team then deploys again, consumes the brand new version of the security CI build.
Right.
And then their pipeline will flow through to production. By the time it gets through all the test phases, the security team will have reviewed it and say whether it can go or not go to production.
Yeah, whether it'll have an impact when it's in production or not. Just because the Qualys scan has found something doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually a risk in the specific case.
Yeah, so we just want to shift our security testing left as far as possible so that it's not picked up in production. So that's the same way with everything else.
Mm.
So with our networking, our codes, our infrastructure, we want to test it and it for it to break in QA.
So what do you guys' workday look like? You don't spend a lot of time actually configuring stuff, is that a fair statement? What do you actually do all day then?
So we're onboarding applications onto the platform at the moment. So basically by Christmas time, we're looking to onboard 100 applications.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of taken up our time. So we've created a set of templates. We use ThoughtWorks Go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just creating ThoughtWorks Go templates for the different profiles of application. Because that example I gave you before was a stateless web server. So we have some applications, obviously, that have caching layers and have state. So we're using Pure Storage for that state. For instance, our Exchange will sit on journal files. So the operating system is deployed and rolled over where they will mount volumes on Pure Storage using OpenStack Cinder.
Mm.
And then we'll basically they'll persist the state. Mm. So we blow away, we have an immutable OS that sits on top of that, while the state will sit on the Pure Storage. And we've also got NFS with NetApp that we're looking to use.
So you're using a storage array as the back end, you're not using IP storage, which was one of my questions.
No, so we use local disk as well. So we basically use it's our HP boxes. For our hypervisors, and we use local disk, but for the more performant applications that require flash solution, we use Cinder volumes for that.
Right. And the advantage of Cinder volumes is it's part of OpenStack, so it's very easy to orchestrate.
Yeah, so that's got an API as well. So rather than us going to Pure Storage directly and having to learn their API, every storage vendor just plugs into the Cinder and we just call out to the Cinder API. So if we wanted to use another storage vendor, our orchestration would work for both those storage vendors in the same way as long as they have all the features and applicable to the API.
So today your most of your time is spent configuring YAML files to onboard those new applications and do things like VLANs and routing and security and things like that?
Well, it's really training the test the development teams to do that. Because our developers are, it's a self-service model.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what we're trying to do is educate them on how to fill in them and then how it uses the common workflow actions that we've developed using Ansible. So really it's most of the time spent educating the developers to get the most out of the platform.
Baseball bats, or like, do they listen? Sorry.
To be honest, the developers are fantastic. Yeah. I'm not joking.
Some of them are right behind you, right?
Yeah. I'd like to say the security team's also great. They're sitting next to me too.
So, I mean, from your experiences, I mean, a lot of people are pretty skeptical about OpenStack, and they say it's like a big science project and it's never going to be in use by, you know, enterprises or by normal companies, and everybody's going to end up in the public cloud. Does that, you know, obviously, where do you sit on that scale? Is there a long-term future for this, or is it just an interim step, or is it fine? It works perfect.
Well, for us, OpenStack has been completely solid. I think Gartner have even said it's not a science project anymore. So, we were at the last OpenStack summit and said that. So they changed their mind. So,
I think that was after it became clear that enterprise customers actually wanted OpenStack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so that's where the money comes from. So you better not be criticizing OpenStack to your customers. Yeah.
Yeah. So for us, it's been a great platform. It's completely solid, and we haven't actually seen any issues with it. What I would say is there's a huge difference between taking one of the hardened OpenStack distributions rather than just going to GitLab, downloading it and installing it yourself. So we've used Red Hat's hardened version, but there's also other distributions that people can use. So I would say, like, if you try and install it yourself, that's probably where some of the issues have come from, because there is quite a high barrier of learning that you have to go through to maintain it. But once you actually understand it, it's essentially just like a MySQL database with RabbitMQ and lots of other open source technologies. So it's not actually that difficult once you look under the bonnet and use it through a while.
What about you, Mark? What's your experience been? Because you come from you're a CCIE, you come from a networking background, you know, 20 years of torment and pain in traditional, you know, chassis-based switches in tree-based architectures.
Interesting times, I think, Greg. I've working for Paddy Power Betfair, my focus was on delivering the physical network and doing the SDN integration. Decided that automating the underlay would need to be a big part of that. So for me, it's been a learning curve on that side of things, you know, learning what Ansible can do in that vein. The zero-touch provisioning, as I've already talked about. And the power of automation becomes clear. And I think for me, talking about software-defined networking, when you see that element automated, you suddenly get the power of SDN, a single API that's available for that automation and for it to be delivered in software. It all suddenly becomes clear. And really, you should just view SDN, in my opinion, as a part of a toolkit for automation. The power of automation has been really interesting and kind of getting.
Has it changed your work life? Do you think that? I'm hoping to set up a podcast with some resellers, some, you know, executives from resellers, and talk about the changing nature of the industry. But does it change the way, you know, sales are made, or change the way you look at technology? You know, that old days, years of, you know, ConfT and do something, work finish, walk away, charge by the hour. Whereas this sort of sounds like you spent months doing preparatory work, and then after that, you don't really need to spend an hour here, an hour there, futzing around doing day-to-day changes.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. From my perspective, working for Computer Center, I've kind of been partly responsible for the SDN strategy for a few years, and now I'm kind of talking to customers about automation as the use case, removing network as a blocker by automating, use SDN as a toolkit for that. And that's, you know, I think people have got to start to get their head around that, and it needs to be seen to be believed, really.
I think it's basically the same evolution that infrastructure engineers went through before. So essentially, they would take weeks to rack and cable servers. So you're only as fast as the slowest component in the slowest component and bottleneck has kind of become networking, and that's where SDN comes in to aid that, so that it can be give you that AWS like ability in the private cloud. So that's really where OpenStack comes in. It's basically bridging that and giving people that ability. And it is changing the way that people operate. So essentially, network engineers now are having to maybe learn how to use APIs, program against SDKs, you know, learn a bit of Python.
Sure.
And that's probably not a natural...
Well, I think it is for some people, but there's also a certain amount of people in networking who've never had a computer science background, never done a university degree in programming, or, you know, they've just come in and they know that if they conf-t this and bang that, you know, whatever it is, that's the networking to them. And I think those people will struggle. They'll have a harder transition than others who maybe have a more disciplined scientific, you know, computer science background.
I mean, for me, on this kind of the journey that I've been on, you know, I came to realize that with networking, after you've been doing it for a while, you rely on a set of fundamental skills, kind of like the base of everything that you do, and therefore taking on new technology is just about learning particular CLI commands. When I came to do the automation of the underlay, suddenly I'm faced with Ansible and no question mark that tells me what I might put in next in the command. So, you know, you have to kind of learn some of these coding fundamentals, really, to get into it. But it's been really exciting. And, you know, there have been one or two occasions where I've been creating playbooks and I've got some fairly complex testing piece to work where I've been jumping up and punching the air and everybody looking at me like I'm mad. but it's been, you know, it's great fun. And actually, it kind of invigorates your passion again for technology, because
because you and I have worked together in the past and lived a fairly miserable set of experiences.
I wouldn't go that far, but it was becoming, you know, for me, it was becoming a bit, you know, also ran at times.
This module isn't compatible with this version of the operating system in this Ethernet chassis, and you know, this load balancer doesn't have this feature, so let's upgrade the code. Oh, it still doesn't have that feature. Oh, nobody doesn't have the answer. You know, you feel more empowered or something.
Yeah, but you know, now you have an opportunity to do something different and something exciting. You know, creating the custom plugin with Arista through a combination of Python and Ansible, just to get the spine configuration done at the same time as the leaf configuration when you deploy, is awesome. Great fun. And I would recommend anybody starts to look at putting a toe in the water of things like Ansible. Ansible is a great place to start. You know, if you look at if you kind of look at most switch vendors now, I think there are some pre-written Ansible modules. Certainly with Arista, there are. I believe there are with Cisco. If you have access to the NX API, then you know that's all good.
NetMiko is the one, which is a CLI module. You start with some Python, and NetMiko is a Python module that talks directly to the SSH consoles of most switches. And that's a great place to start for really small-scale little changes.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is what I'm talking to customers about, is your automation can be all-encompassing, like Steve's CI/CD pipeline, or you can just start to automate everyday tasks just to speed things up a little bit, maybe remove some human error once you've proved out workflows, you know, that those types of things, and you can start small and build it out. And when you gain confidence, it just depends on the customer's appetite, their use case, what they're trying to do. But, you know, conversations around SDN invariably develop into conversations about cloud.
Yes.
Therefore, it's maybe even a different audience we need to talk to, but certainly it's a more rounded conversation that you need to have now.
I think it's also you've got to talk to your managers differently too. So you can't leave the executives out of it. You have to come to them with a, you know, we're going to change everything. I mean, the one question I haven't asked you is, Steve, I bet you don't have change control.
No, we still do have change control.
Only for the network, though.
yeah, to be honest.
Yeah, but I mean, it's less of an issue now, obviously, because we're not touching the network so much.
When you're working in the underlay, not when you work in the overlay.
Yeah, so basically for deployment pipelines, we cut change control tickets that are pre-approved as part of the production pipeline, so that we still have change control and we still have change phrases. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that eventually we'd kind of like to get away with, because away from. I think
well,
that's
theory,
just my
your
opinion.
Testing should be able to take away any risk of change in the end, but maybe it'll take a while to get there. Is that what you?
It takes a while for a business to actually understand and build confidence in that. So we're still at the start of the kind of journey. So we're still onboarding the applications, but I think we'll see those benefits, and change control will basically be a developer check-in at the end of the day that's pre-tested through all parts of the environment before going into production, and that will build the confidence, because we really just want to automate everything we possibly can, because we want to get basically have reliability and get the applications out to market as quickly as possible. But I think one of the misconceptions around automation is it just makes things go faster. I think one of the other things is basically allows you to produce the same results over and over again. And the predictability is the main point.
Yeah, accuracy of the change. Once you've tested that workflow, it should be repeatable.
I think, I agree with that one. I think that's important. But I think for me, the most important part is visibility. So now your SDN controller is the one source of truth in the network that it controls, and you actually know what everything's doing. You don't have to telnet to 25 different devices to confirm everything's working.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things for us with NewEdge, we've been able to break out policies. So as opposed to having one massive policy with all your ACL rules on it, each microservice application has its own policy. So from a security perspective, a security engineer can just go look at that policy and see precisely what that microservice application is talking to. Mm-hmm. I think that's really one of the huge benefits that we've got with this model.
Yeah, so that's not visibility, that's configuration data, I think, then, perhaps.
There's still visibility of what's actually happening, because in previous networks, if you've got stateful firewalls between a front-end, back-end, and business logic, you probably don't know within that what particular applications, what ports they're using, what they're actually talking to, so it helps with auditability of the system. Mm.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster, because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
Oh, well, thanks very much for joining us today and listening to the Packet Pushers. Steve, where can people find you on the internet? Can they find you? Do you have a website, a blog, or have you got a book that you've published yet?
Yeah, so I'm actually publishing a DevOps for Networking book that's focusing more on the automation aspects. That'll come out around October. I also have my Twitter handle, which is Steve9Armstrong. That's basically it.
All right. And Mark, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I'm a bit shy and retiring, but you can find me on Twitter at MarkPryor4. And I'm hoping to get to proofread Steve's book.
Send me a copy as well. Well, on that note, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blogs at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. Today's show is not sponsored. Although we've mentioned a number of vendors across the length of the show, there is no sponsorship here. There's no alignment. There's no hidden money exchanging hands. This is literally, we're talking to real customers and real engineers about their experiences, just in case you get the wrong impression. Don't forget to sign up to our Human Infrastructure newsletter, which we publish every fortnight or so. If you go to packetpushers.net and click the links, you can subscribe to that newsletter, and we send out some, we'd like to think it's interesting stuff for you to read. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.